From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a first-person account of the AIDS epidemic in Africa. We talk with Stephen Lewis, UN Special Envoy for HIV and AIDS in Africa. He's called the lack of assistance provided by wealthy countries mass murder by complacency. He's pleased that President Bush recently announced he wants to triple American funding for fighting AIDS in Africa. But Lewis is concerned that war with Iraq will distract the world's attention away from the pandemic. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Gilligan's Wake, a new novel by Tom Carson that draws from both the TV show Gilligan's Island and James Joyce. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Britain, the U.S., and Spain have submitted a new resolution to the U.N. Security Council that sets the stage for war in Iraq. But other council members are countering this with their own proposals to continue weapons inspections. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
The joint U.S., British, and Spanish resolution says Iraq has failed to take the final opportunity afforded to it in Resolution 1441. That's the one that gave Iraq a final chance to disarm or face serious consequences. U.S. officials hope to persuade a majority of the 15 council members to support the text, but Washington is facing an uphill battle. Germany, France, and Russia circulated their own proposals today, saying 1441 has not yet been exhausted. They want to see U.N. weapons inspectors set out a clear timetable to destroy Iraqi weapons programs. Chief UN Inspector Hans Blix has already given Iraq one major test to start destroying its Al-Samud II missiles and related equipment by Saturday. The White House argues those missiles are just the tip of the iceberg. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
CBS Television is reporting that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein is refusing to destroy those missiles that UN inspectors have ordered him to eliminate. CBS anchor Dan Rather said Saddam insisted in an interview today that the missiles do not exceed the 93-mile range set by the UN in 1991. Rather also said Saddam challenged President Bush to an internationally televised debate. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer has already dismissed that offer as not serious. Rhode Island's governor is asking President Bush to declare a major disaster for the state in the aftermath of a deadly nightclub fire. Av Harris reports from member station WRNI.
Governor Don Carcieri says President Bush called him to express sympathy for the victims of the fire and pledge any federal support possible. The disaster declaration would free up federal dollars for services from crisis counseling to reimbursement for local fire and police crews. Rhode Island Senator Jack Reed says the unique circumstances of this fire warrant such a presidential declaration.
The scale is beyond comprehension. It's the fourth largest fire of this type in the history of the country. There are 97 fatalities. There are numerous people who are injured. Those injuries are going to take millions of dollars of health care and medical expenses.
State officials have temporarily banned all indoor pyrotechnic displays and are inspecting all Rhode Island nightclubs to make sure they comply with the state fire code. For NPR News, I'm Av Harris in Providence.
Attorney General John Ashcroft said today that there are no plans to reduce the level of the national terrorism alert. Ashcroft said U.S. intelligence is aware of enough threats to justify keeping the level at orange or high risk. The level was raised earlier this month. In stocks, the Dow lost 160 points to close at 78.58 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 26 points. This is NPR News. A federal jury in Alexandria, Virginia, has refused to impose the death penalty on Brian Regan, the man convicted last week on charges of attempting to sell U.S. military secrets to Iraq and China. Regan is a former Air Force Master Sergeant who worked at the National Reconnaissance Office, which operates spy satellites for the government. Prosecutors said Regan drafted letters to leaders in Iraq, Libya, and China offering to sell military secrets for $13 million. They never claimed that the 40-year-old analyst ever actually passed the secrets. The search for debris from the space shuttle Columbia continues in a remote section of southeastern Nevada today. NASA believes a large portion of space shuttle landing gear may have fallen in the area. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City.
The search area is hundreds of miles west from where other space shuttle debris was found, but video of Columbia's descent to Earth and air traffic control radar have space agency officials focused on a 30-square-mile area near the Nevada-Utah border. This weekend, searchers found what appeared to be small pieces of shuttle debris. The material looks like aluminum foil and has strands of fiberglass attached. It'll be sent to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana for analysis. A NASA contractor at the scene says he doubts the material found so far is from the space shuttle. About 80 volunteers and professional trackers are involved in the search. NASA hopes to find a portion of Columbia's landing gear, which could help explain why the spacecraft broke apart. A similar search 80 miles east near Zion National Park was suspended Sunday. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
In stocks, the S&P 500 lost 15 points to close at 832. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children. On the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Stephen Lewis, is the UN's Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa. He says the pandemic cannot be allowed to continue, and those who watch it unfold with a kind of pathological equanimity must be held to account. He adds, there may yet come a day when we have peacetime tribunals to deal with this particular version of crimes against humanity. Lewis was pleased with President Bush's announcement that he wants to triple America's funding for fighting AIDS in Africa, though he worries that war with Iraq will distract world attention from the pandemic. Lewis formerly served as Canada's ambassador to the UN, deputy head of UNICEF, and special advisor on African economic recovery. He recently toured four countries in southern Africa, Lesotho, Zimbabwe, Malawi, and Zambia. I asked him to elaborate on how he thinks war with Iraq might affect the AIDS pandemic in the region.
Well, war always has the effect of diverting resources, diverting attention, diverting energies, diverting coverage. War is an entirely preoccupying reality, and this looming war with Iraq is a preoccupying reality not just for the United States and its allies, but also for the rest of the world, because there are such profound religious and political divides. And what happens in that kind of situation is that a continent like Africa gets short shrift, that you forget the other human and moral imperatives, that they just get lost. It reminds me very much of what happened after the war in Afghanistan, a perfectly understandable extension of September the 11th. But nonetheless, the war in Afghanistan took away from, drew from all of the attention of the world in other, on other areas of human need and human predicament. So all of us who watch this unfolding and know that we're dealing with this catastrophic HIV/AIDS pandemic in Africa, and know that we have built some momentum, which was evident in the President of the United States State of the Union address when Mr. Bush announced that significant additional amount of money. We know that all of that could unravel if the war begins and takes everyone's attention away from what is happening in Africa.
Do you think the AIDS casualties in Africa are as bad as the casualties of most wars?
They're much greater than the casualties of most wars. I don't know, Terry, whether people fully understand this, but as the AIDS pandemic works its way through Africa and now seeping inexorably into Asia, into Russia and the Eastern Bloc, we're going to take a larger toll in human life than the famous Black Death of the 14th century. But if you want something more contemporary, AIDS is going to take a greater toll in human life than both the wars of the 20th century, military and civilian casualties combined. We're talking about potentially 70 to 100 million deaths, because that's the way the pandemic is moving.
You're talking about just Africa or around the world?
Well, Africa's already lost close to 20 million people. There are 30 million infected. All those people are, for the moment, in the absence of treatment, doomed. So I think Africa alone could see those numbers. If you move into the rest of the world and we don't manage to stop the pandemic in India, in China, in Russia, then I don't even want to think about the figures. And I don't know how to translate it in human terms because those figures are so abstract. What do they mean? What you have to think about is all the women and the orphan children and the families ripped apart and the extended families lost and countries literally fighting for survival.
The CIA has warned that AIDS in China, India, Russia, as well as Africa, is a mounting security threat for the United States. What does the CIA mean by that?
They mean that as the HIV/AIDS pandemic takes its toll, the societies begin to fall apart and all the big sectors of society are affected. It's therefore not merely the human tragedy. It's the shredding of all the infrastructures. You're seeing that now in southern Africa with the food shortages and the near famine in several countries in southern Africa. And what has happened, of course, is that over the last 10 years or so, 7 million agricultural workers, overwhelmingly women because women do the farming, agricultural workers have died. And so many of the people have reduced immune systems because they're infected by HIV that when you add that to the food shortages, then it means that everything falls apart. People are subject to a much more rapid progression of the disease and a much more rapid progression towards death. And we're seeing that all over southern Africa. I was in the four countries that are most grievously affected, Lesotho, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Malawi, in December and again in January. And frankly, we were horrified by what we encountered, those of us who were traveling for the UN. Because this wasn't a food shortage and hunger induced by drought and erratic rainfall, as first was thought. This was a food shortage and hunger induced in large part by AIDS, because AIDS had caused the whole society to fracture. I remember meeting with the Minister of Agriculture in Zambia. And he said, by way of anecdote, he said, you know, I had a meeting, Mr. Lewis, 10 days ago with the European Commission. They brought 10 people to the meeting. I attended the meeting alone. And he said, I attended it alone because so many of the senior people in my ministry were dead. I had no one to bring with me. And you see, what has happened in agriculture is happening, for example, in education. Zambia loses 2,000 teachers a year. It graduates from its teachers' colleges fewer than 1,000. How do you keep your education system together when kids are leaving schools to look after sick and dying parents, when the teachers are dying or they're absent because they're sick? So progressively you shred the agricultural sector, the education sector, the health sector, the private sector, often the military, whose rates of infection are inevitably higher than those of the civilian population. And that's what the CIA means by a security risk, that the entire country is then subject to destabilization because you've got huge numbers of orphans wandering the landscape, rootless and angry and bewildered, and you've got a society struggling for survival. Do you know, we heard the word extinction used more than once.
In relationship to what?
In relation to the countries. We heard heads of state say they were fighting to prevent their country from extinction. It's the first time I've heard that word. I've heard fighting for survival, fighting for our lives. We don't know whether we'll make it. We could be a failed state. I had not before heard the word extinction.
Are there any tribes or ethnic groups within Africa that are already on the verge of extinction?
Well, there are countries where the prevalence rates of HIV/AIDS are so high that they really are fighting for survival. Botswana has a prevalence rate of over 38% amongst the 15 to 49-year-olds. So try to imagine it. One out of every three, two out of every five people who are infected. Botswana is tremendously fortunate. It has some mines and it has diamonds and it has one of the few countries in Africa which has some surplus from previous budgets. So they're working hard at putting a treatment program into place and doing intense prevention. But frankly, they're really fighting to save the life of the country. Swaziland, which has a prevalence rate as high as Botswana now, doesn't have the same resilience and the same capacity to respond. It's unbelievably impoverished. Remember, most of these countries live on less than a dollar a day per person. So they are so poor that to find the resources to respond, it's just not available.
A lot of our listeners might be thinking, yeah, the problems in Africa are very grave, but the Bush administration is recommending giving $15 billion for AIDS in Africa, so that will really help a lot. If the $15 billion actually comes through, how much of a dent will it make in helping to reverse the epidemic?
Oh, it will make a dent if it's well and intelligently used. It will make a very considerable dent because we've just never had those kinds of figures before. But if you put it in perspective, if it's $3 billion a year for 5 years, everybody understands that we need a minimum of $10 billion to do the job now. And by the year 2007, those who study it say we will need over $15 billion. So while the American offer, the American commitment, is a quantum leap forward and changes the pattern of indifference and negligence which has characterized the Western world for years, it still doesn't begin to confront the amounts that are needed in order to turn the pandemic back. Now, I beg you to put it in context. $10 or $15 billion over 5 years sounds like a lot of money. $10 billion a year sounds like a lot of money. But people who have estimated the cost of a war in Iraq are talking about $100 billion and better. So in relative terms, we're asking for very small amounts of money to attempt to save the lives of over 2 million people a year.
My guest is Stephen Lewis, the UN's Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Lewis. He's the UN Special Envoy for AIDS in Africa. We've talked a little bit about the staggering statistics in Africa. I'm wondering if you could just give us a couple of scenes of things that you witnessed on your recent trip to Africa that would also help convey a sense of how bad the epidemic is there.
Well, the scenes haunt the mind. It's just very hard to deal with them. As I'm talking to you, I find myself, just as the images run through my mind, I find myself becoming unsettled and emotional. I think one of the worst moments I had was in the university teaching hospital in Lusaka in Zambia. But frankly, it's equivalent to any hospital in southern Africa at the moment. I was in the pediatric nutrition ward, where the HIV infection rate is roughly 56%, and where there was great hunger in the country as well as AIDS. And you wander through the ward. I'll tell you exactly what it was. I went in with the administrator and the head of the ward and all these little morsels of infants. They were 6 months to 2 years old, three and four to a bed, their mothers hovering anxiously around. And you walk down the corridor just so overpressed, not enough nurses, not enough doctors, not enough beds, everybody in a kind of paralysis of anxiety. And then suddenly, as you're walking, you hear this wail breaks out. It's so shocking and so visceral. And you turn around and you suddenly understand what's happened, that one of the little infants has died. And the mother, her head buried in the bed sheet beside her dead child, is weeping. And in comes a nurse and wraps up the child and takes the child out. It's all so so horrifying and unexpected. And then you walk to the end of the ward trying to get the image out of your mind, and suddenly there is another terrible shriek of dread, and you realize that another child has died, and another mother is collapsed in sadness and the tragedy of it. And then we walked out of the ward into an open area going to what was the pediatric respiratory part of the hospital, where the infection rate is 72%. So many of the infants have tuberculosis. And we're in the open area, and through the windows of the ward we've just left comes another howl of pain. And it's like Kafka and Dante and Poe. It's like everything wrapped into one crazed moment. You wonder, has the world gone mad? How is this happening? Why is it happening? Why have we allowed it to happen? And you know, you get that sense in hospitals in Africa now, where 70 to 80% of the admissions can be for HIV/AIDS related cases. I remember when I was in the Harare Hospital in Zimbabwe a year or so ago, while I was on the adult male ward, they were wheeling in aluminum coffins and removing people who had just died from their beds and putting them in the coffins and wheeling them out. I mean, it's such an indignity to people.
And where do you come in? You're the UN Special Envoy for AIDS in Africa. You witness these horrors. You're able to describe these horrors in an alarmingly powerful way. So then what's within your power to do something?
The power is terrifyingly limited. I feel as impotent as I do empowered. I have a job. It is to see what's happening, to talk to the United Nations family in the country about the way in which we can more vigorously intervene and support what the government is trying to do against the pandemic, to speak to the donors, to work with civil society and all the NGOs, to work with the associations of people living with AIDS. They are brave, courageous people, not many in every country who have openly declared their status, but when they do, God, they are good people, and they deserve support. And then I come back and I report directly to the Secretary General, and we get a chance to meet with heads of agencies and heads of departments and discuss collectively what more the United Nations can do to give leadership to what is happening. You see, if I may digress for just a moment, what is happening is horrifying. The way women die in their homes in the presence of their children is horrifying. The way in which women are disproportionately targeted by the virus.
We'll get to that in a minute. Okay. I do want to talk with you about that.
Well, setting aside then for the moment that part of it, I want to say that there's no need to be annihilated by it all. It is possible to defeat this pandemic. We know what to do. I mean, that's what's important to understand. We know what to do in prevention. We know what to do in treatment. We know what to do in care. We have models and projects and proposals and interventions all over the continent. They're small. We've never had the resources to generalize them through the country, to take them to scale. But there are some brilliant interventions, and there's a tremendously strong resource at the community level to implement them. There are community-based organizations, faith-based organizations. We don't have to be stymied by the horror, except that for the moment, in the absence of resources and support, the horror tends to overwhelm.
Now, you refer to the gender inequality of AIDS in Africa, and women and girls are particularly hard hit. And I think the statistic is for girls aged 15 to 19, it's like twice as many girls as young men who have HIV. What's behind that gender disparity?
As a matter of fact, in the age group 15 to 19, it's in some places even worse than that. In a number of places, girls are 5 and 6 times more susceptible to infection than boys of that age. Look, Africa is a continent steeped in gender inequality. That's the culture. It's the culture in much of the developing world. But there isn't a single country in this world, not on the planet, which has real gender equality. In Africa, gender inequality is fatal. And the predatory sexual behavior of adult men, the intergenerational sex, older men forcing sex on younger women and girls. You know, the women and girls have no sexual autonomy. They can't say to a man, you must wear a condom. They have no power over their own sexuality. There is a cultural oppression there, which is so deeply entrenched that it's going to take a long time to overcome it. And that gender inequality is felt institutionally. It's felt in the world of work. It's felt in farming. It's felt in education. It's felt everywhere. It's particularly bad in the areas of sexual violence and of rape and of marital rape, and the laws are inadequate to respond. What we really need in Africa is a massive campaign on gender equality, treating every single aspect of a woman's life, from property rights and inheritance right through to sexual violence, in order to overcome it.
Stephen Lewis is the UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback Atonement by Ian McEwan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, safe sex and fatalism. We continue our conversation with Stephen Lewis, UN Special Envoy for AIDS in Africa. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Gilligan's Wake, a new novel by Tom Carson inspired by Gilligan's Island and Finnegan's Wake. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Stephen Lewis, the UN's special envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa and Canada's former ambassador to the UN. He recently toured four countries in southern Africa. When we left off, we were talking about how gender inequality has affected the spread of AIDS through Africa. From very far away, it's easy to think about Africa, well, you can't completely plead ignorance anymore because the epidemic is so widespread, you can't help but see its existence around you. So why would you have unprotected sex in an environment like that when you know that that's the way to get sick yourself?
Well, because changing sexual behavior turns out to be the most difficult thing in the world to achieve. Achieving awareness is not so difficult. There are some countries that claim, and I think they're right, a 95 to 100% awareness of how the virus is transmitted heterosexually. And there is even awareness of how to protect oneself. And yet, because of sexual behavior, there isn't behavior change. There's a big gulf between the awareness on the one hand and the behavior change on the other, and we haven't yet got to the behavior change. But you can see in a country like Uganda or a country like Senegal or progress we're making in the 15 to 19-year-old age group in Kenya, Zambia, and Namibia, you can see that intense prevention programs, which explain and which are graphic and which are direct, and you know, you absolutely starkly set out the facts for young people in schools and through drama and music and poetry and song and dance at community level, you can get people to change their sexual behavior. But it does take a lot of time. And in the meantime, a lot of people are being infected.
Do you think that there's more awareness about how AIDS is spread now and more openness and discussion of sexuality?
Oh, God, yes. It's astonishing what's happened. Even in the last 2 years. And it's also the political leadership in Africa who were steeped in the 1990s in denial and in silence, except for special countries like Uganda, where you had a President Museveni who early on understood what was at stake and just refused ever to make a speech without talking about AIDS, wouldn't allow his cabinet members to make speeches without talking about AIDS. And gradually, the prevention programs grew so that the prevalence rates in Uganda, which were between 25 and 30% in the early 90s, are now down, believe it or not, to 6 or 7% in 2003. That's an astonishing decline, and it shows it's possible. And what's happened, I think, is that the African leadership in the last 2 or 3 years has become so horrified by the sense of their societies falling apart that they really are engaged, and there's much more talk about it. And it's just amazing how frank. I did a question and answer, Terry, with about, 800 or 900 Ethiopian high school students in Addis Ababa some months ago. And I was stunned by the frankness and openness of the questions. There wasn't the slightest embarrassment about discussing intimate sexual detail.
Would this have been unimaginable when you first started visiting Africa?
Absolutely, absolutely unimaginable. In fact, tell you the honest truth, I felt as I was sitting there, it was faintly surreal. I felt it was unimaginable even as I was hearing it. But it showed how quickly the societies are recognizing that this is an unbelievable catastrophe and they have to do something about it. But it's all happened late and they've never had the resources.
Are condoms readily available through Africa?
The male condom is available in most countries in significant numbers. Frequently, the Ministry of Health will make them available. Frequently, big NGOs will make them available. There are times when there are shortages and when they're not available, and that's usually some kind of breakdown in the pipeline of delivery. What hasn't been available, largely because of cost, is the female condom. Mm-hmm. It's being used more widely now in South Africa. They're making a real effort to distribute the female condom. And it, of course, has the huge advantage of the woman being able to take control over the sexual transaction.
Assuming she's not being raped, in which
assuming,
she wouldn't
oh,
have
yes,
that control.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah.
What about prostitution? Are you seeing any changes in prostitution?
Well, it remains, commercial sex work remains a very serious, high-risk group for transmission of the disease. It particularly happens at border crossings when truck drivers are backed up overnight before they can cross. It happens when people, the migration of workforces from one country to another, if one of the countries has mines, then frequently the workers will go to the mines. They're away from their families. They go to prostitutes. The virus is transmitted. The routes that the truckers take, the work migration, the availability of commercial sex in some of the urban centers, these are things that drive the virus. There are very considerable efforts made to get commercial sex workers out of the trade and into an alternative. But it's important to understand, I think, that a lot of the women who are in commercial sex work are in what we call survival sex. It's so difficult in the society to find even pennies to keep body and soul together that some young women are forced into sex for that purpose. And therefore, you have to find alternatives. I was in Mombasa not long ago in Kenya, where a group of 10 commercial sex workers had completely broken from their commercial sex work because they were able to build a little bakery and sell their baked goods in the community, and they were receiving a sufficient income from their baked goods to be able to give up commercial sex work. And while that's very tiny, those are the kinds of methodical interventions that are being tested all over the continent. We call them income-generating projects, is the term of art.
Have you seen a lot of different attitudes among the people of Africa about the epidemic in terms of their own vulnerability to it and how they deal with that vulnerability? Have you seen some people who are just fatalistic about it? I'm going to behave the way I behave, and if I get it, I get it. And seen other people try to, do their best to prevent it from happening.
You see absolutely the whole range of human behavior and human response. There are some really shocking surveys which emerged at the Barcelona International Conference on AIDS last July, surveys that were conducted by UNICEF and UNAIDS, particularly amongst young girls and young women between the ages of 15 and 19, in which they felt in the various countries that they were simply not at risk. They didn't always understand how the virus was transmitted. They assumed just by looking at people, you could tell whether it was safe to have sex with them or not. There were numbers of preconceptions and misconceptions which were very unsettling and showed the need for an intense effort at education. Amongst young boys, there was a tremendous smug egocentricity amongst their entitlement sexually and what they could and could not do and their indifference to the possibility of getting the virus. So you had these various extremes in attitudes, which is based on survey data and allows us to know where to put the emphasis. As one wanders, and I've been doing it now for more than a year and a half intensely in this role, you sense an increasing awareness everywhere. So if I'm sitting in Ethiopia at a little coffee klatch in the late morning with a group of neighborhood women, incredibly enough, as uncomfortable as they would normally be about discussions of sexuality, and particularly in the presence of a white Westerner, they're not uncomfortable at all. They sit over coffee and they discuss what AIDS is doing and what should be done. But then you meet the people living with AIDS in these various countries, and they tell you hair-raising stories of stigma. And you realize how intense the stigma is and how people, if they have the courage to declare their status, they're rejected sometimes from their families, by their neighbors, by their friends. I remember meeting with a group of 10 women or a dozen women in the little town of Arusha in Tanzania just a year or so ago. And they were all living with AIDS. And I said to them, that's very brave of you to be talking so openly about living with AIDS. How does your community respond? And they said to me, we never talk about it in our communities. They don't know we're living with AIDS. We talk about it only if we're here in the urban center of Arusha where no one knows us.
I know availability of drugs is an incredibly important issue in dealing with AIDS in South Africa. Is the problem mostly money? Is the problem mostly that people can't afford to pay for the drugs?
Yes, the fundamental problem there is money. There are other problems. You have weak health systems. You don't have enough doctors, nurses, and counselors to administer the drugs and to follow the patient back to the village and make sure that the drug regimen is followed. But overwhelmingly, the problem is dollars. For a long time, the difficulty was with the pharmaceutical industry, who kept the price of antiretroviral drugs very high. But as President Bush pointed out the other night in his State of the Union address, the drug costs have dropped from $12,000 a year to roughly $300 per person per year for the generic drugs. Now, if you're living in a country where people are earning less than a dollar a day, you can't afford $300 a year. But if there was outside donor money, like that of the United States coming into the country for the purchase of the drugs and the distribution of the drugs, then you could prolong life significantly for very large numbers of people. And that is the desperate struggle at the moment. It doesn't mean that we should diminish prevention for a second or diminish the care of people for a second, but we can prolong lives. I go back to the remarks of the President of the United States. He said 4 million people need treatment now, and only 50,000 are getting it. That's just a staggering comparison.
My guest is Stephen Lewis, the UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Lewis, the UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa. You've given us some pretty horrifying pictures of how AIDS is affecting Africa. When you go home to Canada after spending time in Africa, how does it change you?
Well, I've had a love affair with Africa since 1959. I've been going back and forth to and from the continent for 44 years now. I love the continent. I love the people. I love the music. I love the generosity. I love the kindness. I love the intelligence. It's an extraordinary continent, despite the fact that it's beset by conflict and by disease and by poverty. But, you know, it's too heartbreaking almost to cope with. I know. Look, this isn't a confessional. I don't know much about this program. We're just chatting in a friendly way. But I know that at times I'm emotionally fraying. I know that that I'm not as sober and rational and contemplative as I should be, because it just tears your heart out. It all seems so unnecessary. Because, as I say again, we know how to defeat the pandemic. We could break its back in 4 or 5 years and save millions of lives if only we can mobilize the world. If we mobilize the world around AIDS the way we mobilize the world around war, then we could really overcome HIV/AIDS in a few years' time.
And that would take what? Antiretroviral drugs and more sex education? I mean, what would it take?
Massive prevention programs, antiretroviral drugs, a great deal of by way of resources from the Western world, a kind of Marshall Plan for Africa to overcome the disease, and in the process, saving the world from real agony if it spreads inexorably to China and India, as it now seems to be doing, which will definitely dwarf Africa in numbers.
Is this a difficult time for you to be traveling to Africa as the UN's special envoy for AIDS? Westerners are targets of terrorists in every part of the world right now, and certainly in Africa. So what kind of problems is that causing for you, either problems in terms of anxiety or problems in terms of restrictions that you have to deal with?
Interesting question. Actually, it has caused me not a moment's hesitation or restriction. I travel in large measure alone or sometimes with a colleague. The UN family and the countries that I visit are the people on whom I rely, and then the meetings with government and civil society officials. You know, without seeming to be unstable, I am so seized with this predicament, and anyone would be. This is not a characteristic of Stephen Lewis. Anyone who sees and works with what is happening would be just obsessed with it. And the struggle to overcome it supersedes every other consideration, whether it's insecurity or threats of terrorism or wars.
You have worked with the UN in many capacities. You're Canada's former ambassador to the United Nations, former deputy head of UNICEF, former special advisor on African economic recovery. What do you think of how the UN is handling now the crises of the world, North Korea, Iraq? Are you disappointed in the UN's ability to cope, or do you feel the UN is really behaving in the way that it should be?
The UN is two entities. It's important to recognize that. When it's handling an Iraq or a North Korea in the Security Council, it is fulfilling its role on peace and security, a largely political role, by which it is overwhelmingly judged by everyone. And I think in defense of the UN is then captive to the decisions of the individual countries, the United States, France, Russia, Germany. These countries, which taken together are the sum total of the UN, dictate the UN's terms, conditions, and policies. It's not Kofi Annan. He simply implements what the countries decide. And then there's the other UN. There's the UN which devotes itself to humanitarian priorities and to emergencies and to development. It's the UNICEFs and the population people and the World Food Program and the refugees and the United Nations Development Program. It's all those parts of the UN which day in and day out save lives and deal with the most difficult and grim dimensions of society. That's the UN that is loved and valued and treasured in these developing countries. And it's kind of schizophrenic. We think so completely of the UN and the Security Council when a France and the United States lock horns. And we forget that the primary work of the UN beyond peace and security is with human priorities. And that work is magnificent.
Before you were the UN Special Envoy for AIDS in Africa, you worked as an investigator on the Rwanda genocide. So you've seen the impact of genocide, and you've seen the impact of the AIDS pandemic. You've witnessed, you know, the impact of millions of people dying. What does this do to your sense of proportion? I mean, how do you protect yourself of thinking, oh, another life is lost, big deal, I've seen millions? You know, what does it do to your sense of proportion?
God, that's an interesting question. For one thing, the genocide ended. I mean, at least it had a conclusion. The thing about AIDS, which is so harrowing, is that it seems never to have a conclusion. It just seems to go on and on and on. And you know that the death rates are going to rise to astronomic heights in 2008, 2009, 2010, and all of the orphans will proliferate in huge numbers. It's a generational thing. It's going on. It isn't ending. Proportion. Can I tell you something which interests me? I'm a person who hasn't responded well enough to human agony and despair. It's not that I don't feel it intensely, but it's because as a Canadian, I've always been somewhat distant from it. And like everybody else, you think of these abstract, large figures, and it's hard to put a human face to them. What has happened to me personally in dealing with AIDS is that rather than seeing it in large, every single person now somehow has a vivid reality for me. And I carry in my mind a young woman living with AIDS in Lusaka who had a stroke and has lost the sight of one eye and still in her 20s is fighting to stay alive. And, you know, you carry away with you a sense of a woman in a community who's desperately tending to the sick and the dying, and you carry away with you a young orphan girl of 14 looking after four siblings stoically dealing with the household. And when someone dies, you feel it very keenly in an odd way. AIDS has become personalized. Every single person is like a scar on the soul, because I think because it's all unnecessary. I think it's because you know these people shouldn't be dying, and so each of them individually has a tremendous personal force.
Stephen Lewis, safe travels. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Stephen Lewis is the UN's special envoy for HIV/AIDS. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Tom Carson's new novel, inspired by TV and literature, Gilligan's Wake. This is Fresh Air. For decades, critic Tom Carson has written on TV and popular culture for The Village Voice, Esquire, Rolling Stone, and other magazines and newspapers. He's written a new novel called Gilligan's Wake, which draws heavily on his informed infatuation with classic television series, American history, and world literature. But critic Maureen Corrigan says Gilligan's Wake may be one of those novels you'd like to have with you on a desert island.
I'm always curious about the current state of cultural literacy, so I went into my freshman English classes the other day and asked how many students had ever watched the 1960s sitcom Gilligan's Island. They all raised their hands instantly. Then I told them about Tom Carson's new novel, Gilligan's Wake, which in bebop, stream-of-consciousness fashion retells highlights of modern American history through the voices of each of the characters on the island. A few faint smiles of appreciation, but unlike the reaction I got when I told the same plot synopsis to friends age 35 and over, no out-and-out hoots of laughter at the absurdity of the whole idea. My students, I realized, have only watched Gilligan's Island on the classic TV channel. For them, it's a canonized text, as venerable in its own way as The Great Gatsby, The Day of the Locust, No Exit, Finnegan's Wake, or any of the other highbrow works Carson references throughout his hectic tale. Their relative lack of elitist distinctions makes my students Carson's ideal readers, because he also assumes that the boundaries are porous between high and low culture. Such is the surrealistic quality of American life, according to Carson's novel. Reading Gilligan's Wake and being the beneficiary of a high culture egghead education, I couldn't help but think of the original title of James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, which was Here Comes Everybody. Here Comes Everybody aptly captures the feel of Carson's novel. It's an inspired, mumbo-jumbo, manic homage to the art of both James Joyce and Bob Denver. Gilligan's Wake is structured as a series of autobiographical reflections by the ill-fated passengers and crew of the USS Minnow. The novel opens with Maynard G. Krebs, the beatnik character Bob Denver played on his first TV show, The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis, ranting in the Mayo Clinic's Cleaver Ward to his shrink, Dr. Kildare F. Troop. Holden Caulfield, by the way, is Krebs's roommate. From Krebs's paranoid rantings, he's seen the best minds of his generation destroyed by madness, J. Edgar Hoover, and too much espresso. We go on to the skipper's adventures during World War II with McHale's Navy and JFK's PT-109. Then it's back in time to the rarefied youth of Thurston Howell III, who unknowingly launches an old school chum, Alger Hiss, on his dubious government career. The professor, here a bisexual narcissist, works on the Manhattan Project. Party girl Ginger recalls her one-night stand for racial equality with Sammy Davis Jr., and Marianne loses her all-American virginal view of the world, hobnobbing with Sartre in existentialist-infested Paris. My favorite chapter, however, is the one presided over by Lovey Howell, a character who, even on the original TV show, always seemed to be smarter than she acted. After all, she was the only character who packed enough trunks of clothes in anticipation of possible shipwreck. In Carson's fevered imagination, Lovey is a former flapper, a morphine-popping intimate friend, and I do mean intimate, of Daisy Buchanan. Here's Daisy confessing to Lovey her ambition to write a tell-all novel about Jay Gatsby. It would be about a man that everybody thinks is wonderful because his dreams soar so high and he's so full of ardor and he loves his idea of you so much more than the reality of you, which nobody else thinks deserves love anyway. And how nobody understands that this man is a tyrant and a dictator who carries your head around on a stick, even though he calls it his banner. Because he's in love with himself, but he can never admit that. And so he makes you his idol and loves himself, adores himself, worships himself for having one. I have to admit, as many times as I've read The Great Gatsby, that view of Gatsby as an overbearing emotional bully with boundary problems never occurred to me. But aided by Lovey's astute interjections and asides to Virginia Woolf and Betty Friedan, this clever, if repugnant, revisionary interpretation works. Despite its ambitions to make a big statement about America, the word plays the thing in Gilligan's Wake. If you like reading Joyce and Eliot, enjoy the self-satisfaction of catching references, riffs, and anagrams, this language-drunk novel is for you. If you have no patience for relentlessly illusory writing, well, to paraphrase the immortal theme song of Gilligan's Island, Gilligan's Wake will be an uphill climb.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Blue Poppies, a novel set in 1950s Tibet by Jonathan Falla. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, two views of the Bush administration's economic package. We talk to New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University, and we hear from columnist Bruce Bartlett. He worked for the administrations of Ronald Reagan and the first President Bush. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.